Okay, welcome along to Waxing Lyrical on 95BFM. My name is Phil Armstrong, and for the session we'll be speaking with Mr. Andrew Boak. Greetings, Andrew. How are you?
I'm good, mate. Yourself?
Excellent. Yes, very well. Thank you. Okay, so Andrew, so we'll probably, you know, go back a bit to the beginning of your time in Auckland. So I suppose really the punk scene in Auckland would be the sort of starting place for you, for your story. Would that be correct, or even before that?
Yeah, I mean, kind of before that, I guess. You know, as a kid, you know, my parents gave me piano lessons, and then when I got to my teen years, I decided that piano wasn't cool, and so I wanted to play guitar. So I did a few guitar lessons and so on. And around about when I was like 15 or so, I had a cousin come back from London with a bunch of like 7 inches from the Jam and Holidays in the Sun by the Sex Pistols and so on. And he put it on the record player, and I was just blown away. It was like, oh my God, this is so powerful and cool. And so, you know, that was kind of my introduction to it. And it's like, you know, that's what I want to play. And then with the whole like DIY theory around it, you know, you didn't have to be a masterclass musician to do stuff and so on. I kind of, you know, took all that and got together with a few people and ended up doing a band called The Regulators with Jeff Hayden out of who's in the Mockers now, who I guess are reforming for a bit of a tour right now.
Yeah.
And we had a band called The Regulators, and that was one of kind of like the North Shore bands that was like with the Screaming Memes and the Killjoys and Rebel Truce and
all those Class of 81 bands
and so on. And so it just kind of like it made its own scene. You know, we would play it at people's, little halls and things like that and do gigs here and there. And slowly but surely we managed to start getting gigs over in the city and so on. Now, kind of with my age and so on, I missed really the first wave of punk in New Zealand, you know, with the Suburban Reptiles and Scavengers and so on. I was still, you know, only about 15 back then. But, you know, obviously it was totally blown away by AK-79 and so on and really into it that way. So, you know, slowly but surely we started getting gigs at the Island of Reel and a few places like that. And so we kind of like slowly morphed ourselves into the scene.
Yep.
And then, you know, after being in a few bands, you know, Regulators broke up and so on. And I joined up with Mark Sullivan, who was in the Flicks. And we rehearsed together for about 6 months, just, you know, jamming stuff. And then finally Mark found the Von Wetering brothers that fitted in nicely, and that's how No Tag was formed. And, you know, we started putting stuff together and so on. And we were kind of we were just lucky that we were in the right place at the right time. You know, the Reptiles and the Scavengers and so on had either broken up or gone to Australia or whatever kind of stuff. And so there was kind of like an audience that was there already for us of, you know, people who like punk and so on, plus, you know, venues that allowed punk bands to play. And so we kind of just like kind of fell into that and, you know, we're very lucky from that perspective. So, you know, I kind of see No Tag as more of like a second wave of the punk thing.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't really put us in with the Scavengers and the Reptiles and Toy Loves and so on and so on.
How was the scene back there? Because, you know, there is talk of, I don't know, the Boot Boys and, you know, a bit more violence, shall we say. Maybe that was before No Tag. I don't know if it was that sort of scene was still carrying on a bit for you
guys.
Well,
no, I mean, there always was that kind of thing, and I think there always still is. And you know, I will go on record as saying that, you know, I personally believe that, you know, the amount of violence at a punk show, there was no more than you know, a really bad pub band in South Auckland. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think that you know, when you put loud music on a Saturday night with a lot of drunk people together in New Zealand, there's a decent chance of a fight.
Indeed.
And I think that's more a societal thing than a music genre thing.
Yeah, yeah, no, I understand. I think maybe, you know, the press, obviously it was good fodder for the press, but like you say, in reality it was all over the show. Speaking of BFM, so did you find support from BFM pretty early stage of No Tag recordings and that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously I was working at BFM, so that kind of helped a lot, right?
Indeed.
You know, and I was also doing the Resurrection Punk show back then on Sunday nights from, I think it was 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Yep. Excuse me, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Yeah, yep.
And, you know, and that was cool too because the guy that was helping me, Neil Cartwright, he had a lot of contacts in overseas, and they would send us, like, you know, rear tapes or actual 7 inches of stuff that there's no way you'd ever get it in New Zealand.
Yep.
And so that was really cool to be able to broadcast that. And yeah, and you know, and obviously with no tag, you know, we must have, you know, written one or two reasonable songs because people did come and see us. And like I say, we kind of filled that void after a lot of the original wave of punk bands kind of either left the country or petered out or whatever. And so, yep. You know, so there was a reasonable amount of support. And then, and consequently, you know, BFM at that time and still now is very pro local music. So we were getting played quite a lot on BFM.
Indeed. I remember, you know, as a kid growing up in Whangarei, I brought the EP, and like you say, at the time, you know, there sort of wasn't a lot of New Zealand punk recorded stuff that you could buy, so for me it was very exciting to get it. I thought the production at the time, you know, it stood the test of time. What are your thoughts on that regard, the production of it?
Yeah, I mean, we did really well. Steve Kennedy was the producer, and you know, we did it on a Midnight to Dawn thing because that's all we could afford. And but you know, he did a really, really good job on it. And even, I mean, the fact of the matter is it got re-released by a US label, Radio Raheem, in 2015, at the end of 2015. And you know, they're not going to release something that sounds really, really dated.
Yeah.
And you know, we had to digitize the analog master to you know, send it to them and so on. So when it was mastered by Angus McNaughton, you know, it still sounded pretty damn good, which is not bad for 35 years later.
Indeed. And just another little side thing I remember chatting to you previously about, was it Legalized Dogs that was also on the It's Bigger Than Both of Us compilation?
Yeah.
And it was a slight different remix or something, wasn't it?
We did a slightly different mix of it, yeah. We've kind of had this idea that, you know, if a song's going to be on a compilation or, I mean, even with the re-release of the EP, we did an inner sleeve, so it's slightly different from the actual original.
Yeah.
Steve Kennedy was working in London with us, well, or rather was working in London while we were in London, and he was working in a studio, and we went in and we used some studio trickery to take the guitar, you know, the near guitar bit,
yeah,
at the beginning,
yeah,
and kind of place that in the breakdown in the middle, and it actually goes down in pitch all the way through. So yeah, so it's actually a remix, the one that's on
the compilation,
Bigger Than Both of Us, if that's what you call a remix.
Well, this would be a good time that we will drop in our Legalized Dogs from No Tags EP. It had three songs on it, of course, but it was a 12-inch EP, so it wasn't a 7-inch single. And so yes, here's Legalized Dogs for you listeners, and we'll be back shortly. We'll be right back. Okay, back with Andrew. So you just mentioned also that No Tag. So you went to London, yeah? How was that in London?
Yeah, what happened? The quick story was that we played in New Zealand up until I think about mid '83. We were getting a bit of trouble at gigs, and we said we weren't going to play if there was going to be fights, and so there were fights, and so we didn't play. Mark, the bass player, had decided he was going to go to London. So we kind of broke up. We did get back together for one last gig with supporting the Dead Kennedys at Main Street.
Right.
But then Mark went over to England, and No Tag didn't exist for I think about a year and a half, 2 years. And then Mark came back and basically said, let's get back together, but there's no way we can survive in New Zealand. New Zealand just doesn't have the population or the scene that's big enough to support any kind of alternative acts, really. You have to be more main top 40-ish. I don't know, maybe now there's one or two bigger of the Flying Nun acts that might survive, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mark was right, and so we decided, we'll go to London. So we saved up our money and headed off to London in search of fame and fortune.
Indeed. And how was the fame and fortune in London? It's a cruel city, if you know it can be.
Well, someone once said to us, and I think this is so true, is that, every night in London there's 1,000 bands playing, but there's actually another 10,000 rehearsing.
And
although London is a mecca for the arts and music especially, we were pretty, green about everything that you had to do to make it big, we didn't really record anything. We rehearsed on a very regular basis. We got gigs here and there, but we didn't really have, a manager or anyone kind of advising us or anything else like that. So I think it was kind of, just naivety didn't help us at all. But we went over there and we did play gigs and people came along and so on and so on. So it wasn't the end of the world at all. And of course, personally, the chance to live in London for 5 years and the fact that I was working at Rough Trade as well was just phenomenal.
So I was in London myself as well, but it was sort of early 90s. But Rough Trade Records, amazing record shop. Not just a record store, it was sort of a label as well, wasn't it? So what was sort of your role at Rough Trade?
Well, I worked for Rough Trade Distribution, which was part of the Rough Trade Record label, which was a separate company from the Rough Trade shop. The Rough Trade shop had been sold off so that they didn't have to worry about that neck of the woods. So I was involved in all of the distribution, and that was part of the cartel, which was a whole bunch of other indie distributors all together in one kind of central thing in London.
Yep.
And it got pretty big, and I would say we probably had around about maybe 1,000 to 1,500 titles at any one time that we were distributing.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was right across the, all the genres from, grunge, death, punk to bad electro, beepy, bleepy, blippy stuff, it was everything, a bunch of reggae thrown in there, a whole bunch of indie tunes, everything.
Yeah, yeah. Exciting times it would have been. And was that just the UK or Europe or?
Well, it was UK and Europe, but we did do export orders over to America. There was one guy, Bleaker Bob, who's passed away now, but he owned Bleaker Bob's Records in New York, and he would come over every 6 months with a shopping trolley, and just walk around the warehouse saying, "I'll take two of those. Oh, give me three of those. Give me eight of those. Give me And we'd ship almost like a pallet of records to him once every 6 months. So it was going around the world at least, But more obviously all of England and Europe. And we had like the Smiths and Depeche Mode and some big acts like that. So, we were putting records at number one in the English charts as well. So it was a fairly big operation when I was there.
Yep. In some respects, looking back, that was sort of, maybe the height of independent music, sales wise and so forth. Vinyl, obviously, and, you know, big business in some respects, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, there's a pretty good Channel 4 documentary on the rise and fall of it, and there's a Document and Eyewitness, I think, is a book that was written about it. But yeah, I mean, I think at the time I was there, you know, it really was pretty full on. The indie scene was, you know, just going for it, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it became strong enough to be able to stand on its own in things like the charts and so on.
Yep. I understand. So you did the backing vocals, didn't you, for one of the DK's albums? Their last album, wasn't it?
It was Bedtime for Democracy.
Yeah, you got it. Yep.
So we had this idea when we had decided that we were going to go to England that we would go to LA. We'd fly to LA. We'd bring our guitars and drumsticks, and we would then catch a Greyhound bus across the United States, stopping in main cities, trying to find the punk scene there, saying, hey, we're from New Zealand, we'll play at a gig for free, or, you know, or if you can put us up on your couches or something, right?
Yeah.
And then we had plane tickets from New York to London. So that was the plan. Then Paul the singer decided he didn't want to go via America, he wanted to go via Asia to go to London. So we said, okay. And Carl, Mark, and myself, got it together so we could do some songs as a three-piece. And then about 2 or 3 weeks before we were about to leave, Mark, the bass player's father, had a bit of a health situation. So Mark had to stay a bit longer in New Zealand to help out with the family and the family finances and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it ended up that Carl, Mark, and Carl's brother, Mark, or we'll call him Blaze, as his nickname was, we went to Los Angeles, and we got to Los Angeles, and we kind of spent a lot of our money in the first couple of days. So we thought, oh, we'll go up to San Francisco, because we knew one person up in San Francisco that we might be able to crash at their place. So anyway, so we were hanging out down at More Damn Records, which was the big punk distributor at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Alternative Tentacles, the record label, was also based in the same building. And so we were just kind of hanging out there, sitting on the couch, you know, drinking beer, reading Maximum Rock and Roll. You know, they had their speakers in the warehouse blasting all sorts of, you know, US hardcore we'd never heard.
Yeah.
Right. And Jello came out of his office. He was pretty busy at the time with the Frankenchrist poster thing had just blown up.
Yes. Yeah.
But he came out of the office and he said, you know, if you guys aren't doing anything tonight, would you mind coming and singing some backing vocals on our new record? And, you know, we were totally floored and said, yeah, of course we would. Right. And we'll be there. Right.
Yeah.
So we went to the studio and sang some backing vocals and ended up, on three songs on Bedtime for Democracy.
Brilliant.
So
three songs out. Cool. I think there's roughly 22 songs on that album.
there's quite a few,
there, indeed. So San Fran obviously became your home. Good city that it is. And so are we jumping then in San Fran to Imperial Dub? Or what's the story there from Rough Trade to...
Well, no. Let's go from so I got over and, you know, started working with Rough Trade, and then about 5 months after I'd got over, Rough Trade England declared bankruptcy, and because Rough Trade America was owned by Rough Trade England, it had to also declare bankruptcy.
Yep.
And of course, the irony about it was that once they actually totted up all the numbers over in England, they weren't actually bankrupt, right? It's just that they couldn't get money, like. They couldn't borrow money from the bank based on, like, you know, well, we own the Smiths back catalog, right? You know,
yeah.
It's like your basic bank manager in London would go, who the hell are the Smiths? But anyway, so I was kind of, you know, left without a job, but I had like, you know, a 10-year working visa. So I helped, clean up the bankruptcy and sell off all the assets and all that kind of stuff. And then I did a bit of temp, you know, agency work here and there and whatever. And then I ended up getting my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she had a roommate who was tour managing Godflesh on a Skinny Puppy tour.
Yeah.
And they had problems with a visa getting into the US. And so her guitar tech had gone off on another tour, so she needed someone who knew their way around guitars and amps and was available. And so I was. So I flew out to Chicago, and then they didn't get visas, so we drove all the way to Boston to wait for them there. because the tour started and went up into Canada and then came back down through Boston, and we were going to rehook up with them there.
Yeah.
That's the Skinny Puppy tour.
Yeah.
And that didn't come through. But while I was there, I was talking to Levi Tarkovsky, who was at the time front of house for My Bloody Valentine, and told him, you know, my story of how it wasn't looking good and so on. And he said, well, we need someone to drive a truck and be a road crew and guitar tech for My Bloody Valentine. So I ended up doing that. And that was pretty cool. And then after, and I kind of got in the swing of being, you know, a road crew, a stage management kind of stuff, a guitar tech. And after that, I kind of came back off My Bloody Valentine. And Kathy, my girlfriend slash wife, said, oh, the Chills are coming over. So I gave Martin Phillips a call and said, hey, do you need anybody for your tour? And then ended up going on tour with the Chills for 5 weeks. And then the tour manager of the Chills was doing PJ Harvey's second tour of the US after that. So then I went on tour with PJ Harvey for a while as her, like, you know, stage guy, guitar tech kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, and so on and so on. And then I did like a whole tour with it was like a songwriter showcase tour, and it had like Michelle Schacht and Alan Toussaint, but it also had like Guy Clark, who was like, you know, I mean, the logic of me, a punk rocker from New Zealand, hanging out with a folk slash country like songwriter from Texas, you know, famous, very, very famous songwriter.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre.
What are the odds?
You know, but we got on. Yeah, exactly. But we got on like a house on fire, and have been, and we're friends all the way up to his passing early last year. In fact, I went to a memorial concert in Nashville in August of last year, which was pretty moving. And but you know, it's like, yeah, so I did a probably about 2 years or so of road work.
Yeah. You got to see America.
But then I kind of realized that you know, you can't do your own music if you're going to say to the rest of your band, hey guys, I'm going away for 5 weeks, you know, keep up the momentum. So I kind of gave that up for a while, and I moved back into music distribution. I moved to Imperial Dub Recordings and ran their label for a year or so.
Rightio, yep.
Which is a deep house label owned by Dub Tribe.
Yes, indeed, and based in San Fran, obviously. So was mm-hmm. there sort of, I don't know, touring involved there? Was it more just based in San Fran with that record label?
It was more based out of San Francisco. Like, I did everything. I was like, you know, I mean, I guess my title was general manager. The title that Dub Tribe gave me was Staff of One. But pretty much did everything, and you know, I mean, it did mean that we got to go to I got to go to the Winter Music Conference in Miami every year, which was you know, the dance music industry's conference in Miami with you know, and so on. But I mean, and so that was fun. But
so we're talking the 90s obviously now, aren't we? Is this sort of around the mid 90s or
late 90s, mid to late 90s.
Okay, Matt.
Right, and at the same time, I also started my own record label, a drum and bass label called Green Recordings.
Indeed.
But I did find that I you know, was partial to the drum and bass genre, because to me that was loud, nasty, effed up noises. You know what I mean? That was like mean shit, and to me that was like kind of like the punk rock of dance music. You know, and
totally,
we had
a
couple of DJ producers here in San Francisco that were starting to make some really good stuff, but the English label, there weren't many American labels at all, and the English labels just turned up their nose at it and said, yeah, whatever, you're American, you know, and got very you know, just English about it, I guess, you know, we're the empire and you're not.
Indeed.
Right, you know.
And so
my wife and myself decided, well, you know, we'll put the money down and we'll do it, right? And it was good, you know, we put out I think 14 records in the end, 14 12-inch singles in the end, and you know, probably half of those sold at least all of their 1,000 pressing, or one or two of them we did 1,500 units on. So it was a you know, we didn't make money out of it, but as a you know, as being part of an industry or giving back in some way, you know, your knowledge and what you know, your experience to younger these younger kids making this music was a really cool thing to do.
Were these sales predominantly in the States, or did any of the sales, you know, happen in England? Or
Yeah, some stuff got over to England, but most of it we were selling to directly to distributors in the US.
Yep. One of the bits of music that you've sent me sort of ties into this. You sent me a little MP3 by a band called Scarpa.
As well as doing the dance music stuff, I was still playing, and I was still playing, first off was the three-piece band called Scarpa, which was a kind of like a, maybe a bit Husker Du-ish, or at least the guitarist was a manic Husker Du fan and pretty much played in you know, a Bob Mould type style.
Yep.
Right. But yeah, they did that one recording. And then after I was kind of more into the dance kind of stuff, I did the cardboard truck stuff. Was a couple of people that actually worked at the dance music distributor. The tracks we kind of did on a demo basis were also done with Jason Mouse, who was a US producer, drum and bass producer.
Yep.
So it was a kind of a crossover thing where, you know, I tried to bring in, you know, like, you know, samplers and drum machines meet noisy guitars, kind of was the cool experiment. You know, maybe like a, I don't know, like a Rage Against the Machine type thing or whatever, or even like a Ministry type, you know, full on drum machine-y thing. But yeah, it was cool. It was a bit of a jam band. We only played one or two gigs out, but you know, we recorded one or two pieces, and Jason Mouse put his wonderful touches on it. We actually used to play with a truck cut out of cardboard across the front of the stage, across the front of the all the tables that we had, like all the keyboards and the computer and the mixing desk and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So you know, it didn't look like a whole bunch of wires and all that, you know. But yeah.
Sounds good.
So that was cardboard truck, and that was a good experiment, but it kind of just, you know, really didn't end up going anywhere. You know, I think there was one or two people in the band that were just kind of like doing it as a hobby, whereas,
yeah,
you know, myself and others were, you know, there's always that want to become rich and famous, you know, so.
In the email that you sent me regarding Cardboard Truck, you mentioned a Kiwi guy called Maz was also involved. Did you know him from Auckland, or you just meet him in San Fran?
No, not at all. That was, I don't know. People might know him. His nickname was Maz because he used to drive around in a Mazda, right?
Yeah.
And I think he was like a ski bunny, a ski bum, whatever you call him.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
I think he was a ski bum. And so he worked at, like, you know, Tahoe Ski Resort up here and, you know, probably, you know, spent winters in New Zealand, whatever. But yeah, he was introduced to us, and he had some keyboards and some samplers, and you know, he was a Kiwi guy, so he kind of joined the band. And you know, after the band broke up, I don't think I've ever heard or seen from him ever. So I don't know, Maz, if you're out there and living in New Zealand, hey mate, you know, maybe I'll see you in a few months.
Yeah, get in touch, Maz. Indeed. So if you don't mind, just sort of move on now to your relationship with the old firm Casuals, because I love the recordings that you've done of these guys. Four-track recording, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, what happened was that, you know, I had by this stage there was Skin Effect were previously called Alleged Masterminds.
Yeah.
And I think Alleged Masterminds had done some demos where I used my four-track, and what I did was I would get my rehearsal room, and I'd mic up all the drums, and I'd mix that into my Mackie 16-track mixing disc, and then pull that in as just one stereo track into one of the tracks on the four track. So kind of mix it all the way down to just one track. Mm-hmm. And then I'd have one track for the bass, one track for the guitar, and one track for the vocals. Or if there were, you know, backing vocals or lead break or something like that, then I'd just bounce down the bass and the drums to one track again and so on, and just, you know, which is what you do on a four track. And so the drummer of Alleged Masterminds, or Skin Effect, I'm not sure what we were called at that stage, but had played to Lars Fredriksson of Rancid.
Rancid, yeah.
A copy or the actual, you know, the demo that we had, just to see what he thought. And Lars actually thought, wow, that's amazing. You did this on a four-track in a rehearsal studio? And he called me up and said, you know, hey, I've got this new project and I want you to record me. And I'm like, you know, I mean, Lars was a friend, that, or at least an acquaintance. And I was a bit kind of taken back because, you know, here's a multi-million dollar, recording artist who's wanting to go into a dingy rehearsal room with a four-track cassette recorder when he could, like, walk into a quadruple 48-track digital blah, 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 blah studio, right, with free massages or whatever, you know what I mean, right, if he wanted to. And he was like, no, I want to get back to my roots. And I kind of said, well, you know, you realize it's a cassette four-track, not a reel-to-reel four-track. And he said, yeah, I know. So we spent a couple of weekends, actually one weekend of rehearsals, and then the following weekend actually doing it. And, recorded it in my rehearsal room with, like I say, drums mic'd into a Mackie 16-track disc into the 4-track, and then with, one or two reverb units, that's about it. I mastered it digitally into a GarageBand master, and then it got sent off to a dude who mastered it in Pro Tools, and it went from there. But, originally it was, analog to cassette tape recording.
Indeed. And Lars obviously was happy.
Well, he must have been, because they put it out as their first record. And I think when you listen to it, when I compare it to something that's been recorded in a big, 48-track, 24-track, whatever, studio, you can hear some of the, the roughness that the 4-track has. But I think that's what Lars was after.
Yep.
And when you listen to it, I think it rocks pretty damn hard.
Yeah, I agree with that. We'll definitely play some of that.
We'll be right back.
All right. So let's go on talking about some of the other bands then that you're still currently with, like Skin Effect and of course Blank Spots.
Okay. Well, Skin Effect is. We'll start with Skin Effect. Skin Effect is like my guitar band, where I'm playing guitar still. I still have most of my equipment, or some of my equipment from England that I used at No Tag in England. I have a lot more equipment that I bought here because obviously equipment is much cheaper here. It's currently a two guitar, one bass, and one drums kind of indie alternative punk-ish band. I would say that we kind of look up to like Killing Joke and Noisy, My Bloody Valentine-ish stuff, Wall of Noise kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there's syncopated kind of wire-ish stuff. There's, jangly-ish, Ride and those kind of like band stuff as well.
Yep.
But that's my kind of main songwriting and I sing about half the songs and so on band, right? And they've done a few, we've done a few recordings, but we haven't actually released anything. And we've been kind of rolling through bass players recently, so we haven't been doing a whole bunch of gigs out, but we have played one or two gigs out.
Yeah.
And then there's Blank Spots, which is like, a really good example of why, punk is not dead. It's a three-piece street punk band.
Yep.
We get probably five times more gig offers than what Skin Effect gets. In fact, this weekend I've got a gig in Alameda across the bridge on Friday night, which is a benefit for the Oakland Ghost Ship Warehouse fire.
Oh, yeah.
And then on Saturday night we're playing in San Francisco with another local punk band called The Nerve, who are pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, and on top of that, we're actually I believe next week I finally get some finished product of our first self-titled LP on vinyl.
Oh, cool.
That we've done, believe it or not, on my using Green Recordings, my old drum and bass label, because it still exists as a company.
Yep.
And so that gives me the tax loopholes and everything else like that, and the resale license and blah, 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 blah.
Cool. Yes.
I hope to be able to get some of those over to New Zealand, either through flying out,
yep.
Or in this case it would be flying in, but or I'll shove some in my bag when I come over.
Indeed.
Or somehow I'll get some over there, right?
Good.
It's really cool because, it's still good straight up punk rock. Yes, it's probably a lot faster than the original punk rock and, so therefore has that, United States hardcore edge to it, right? Yep. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty much just good old punk rock,
I've heard.
And I'm playing bass in this band, but I'm a guitarist playing bass. I still use like my New Zealand Paul Crowther made hot cake on my bass, so it's all snarly and nasty and distorted, and I play a lot of chords and I use a pick and all that kind of stuff. So
yep.
So purist bass player would be rolling over in their grave at the moment, and it's really good stuff. And the guy that does the songwriting and sings, Talon, is he's pretty cool. He writes a good little punk pop song every now and then, and so I'm really happy with it. And it's still the good thing about it is I'm playing gigs. We're recording, we're putting out records, we're, doing all the things that you need to do.
Yeah.
And to me, that's like, that's one of the reasons I was put on this planet was to play music. And personally, it's therapy I use that, instead of going and killing someone when I'm pissed off, I can go and plug my guitar in and make really loud noises and bring my mood down that way a bit. But it's also like, being able to share a gift that you're given with other people.
Cool as. No, and we all appreciate that too, brother.
Change for another beer, but I don't spare change. age anymore. New York City, 1995. Yeah, I'm in radio, it's been a ride. Spare and change for another bag, but I don't spare change anymore. Cause every time I do that stuff, it makes me think that I'm tough. But when I wake up on a cold tough walk, I don't spare change anymore. Market Street, I was totally spun. Spare and change for another rail, but I don't spare change anymore. Philadelphia 2003, smoking crack in 1503. Spare and change for another mark, but I don't spare change anymore. Cause every time I do that stuff, it makes me think that I'm tough. But when I wake up,
So, yeah, Blank Spots, I know it's hard, but perhaps you can get the guys to come to New Zealand and do some shows over here, perhaps. Never say never.
I mean, we joke about, like, Skin Effect and or Blank Spots coming over, and the fact that you know, maybe some people would, come and see us just from an interest perspective of, oh, they're from America or that kind of thing. But the problem really is that even if we borrowed equipment and slept on people's couches and everything else like that, you know, you're still talking around about $1,000 to $1,500 US per person in a plane flight. So the only real way you could do it is is if we did like Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, and then even then you might not make much money just in your travel costs and so on to Auckland and Christchurch. So you'd really kind of have to put in Australia, and you know, we haven't got that much contact in Australia, so it's something that could be done, yes, but probably more likely down the road a bit more when we have a bit more of a following in around the world, with releasing records and things like that. And it's interesting because this is something that, you know, I really really hope people in New Zealand realize is that, you know, Tim Edwards and Punk Rock Road Trips, and when he brings over bands like UK Subs and Exploited and Bad Manners and things like that, you know, he's having to drop a lot of money down just for the logistics of doing it. Yep. And if he doesn't make that money back, it comes out of his pocket. So, you know, people in New Zealand have got to realize that, you know, he puts his bank balance on the line a lot. And not only that, there's a lot of work involved. And so he probably, at some stages, I'm sure, even though he might make a bit of money from a tour, his actual per hourly rate after you add up all the time he spent on it versus what he makes is probably only about $2 a bloody hour.
Pretty low.
Right? You know?
Yep.
So, you know, I think that, you know, people have got to, on the one hand, see, you know, people like Tim and people that do that as be thankful that they exist. But they also need to go out and support that kind of stuff, because if you don't support it, it'll just go away.
Yep, and the bands that Tim brings over, they're quality bands, especially the...
Absolutely, right? You know, and when I was living in New Zealand, you know, the most punk thing we got other than the Dead Kennedys, and what do we have, Dead Kennedys magazine, Birthday Party Susie kind of thing, but it wasn't much that was like of the kind of the outer edge, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, most of those bands were at a kind of 3 or 4 or 5 album kind of already released kind of thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, So, you know, I don't think that there was really like someone like Tim back then when I was in New Zealand doing this kind of stuff. And, you know, and that's why I like working with Tim as well. You know, he yep. knows what it's all about.
Indeed he does. Speaking of gigs and so forth back here, so should we have a little chat about the Punk It Up gig that's you're doing? Yeah, another absolutely. One of these coming up?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was in New Zealand in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I was over there and I was like, you know, wanting to play some music and da 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 da. And Kev had was doing a Strummer Day thing at the King's Arms, and yeah. I'd done a Strummerville band over here in San Francisco as the Armageddians. It was pretty much Alleged Masterminds and another guy singing.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of keen on that, and so I tried to get a band together and ended up getting Seamus and Chris on guitar and drums, and was looking for a bass player, and you know, people had kind of suggested a couple of people, and I was moaning to Jed Towne about, like, you know, I couldn't find a bass player, and he said, "Well, bloody we'll do it," right? So we got together and we became a Clash covers band called Bank Robbers.
Indeed.
And we did this Strummer Day thing, I think in 2012 it was, and that was really cool. And so when I was coming back to New Zealand just for a visit in 2015, you know, I put out the feelers to the No-Tag guys one more time, like I'd been doing for, you know, quite a few years.
Yep.
And they all said yes this time. And, you know, some of it might have been based on the fact that the EP was being re-released by the US label. But so we put together a gig called Punk It Up, which had, you know, No-Tag reforming for a few songs, and then obviously the Bank Robbers playing as like a covers band,
yep.
You know, murdering some perfectly good songs.
That was, it was great, though. Great performance.
But then, you know, put some other bands. We were very lucky. We had the Cavemen before yep. they disappeared to England, opened, and so on. So I'm heading back over again soon, and we're going to do another Punk It Up. And same kind of concept. It's at the King's Arms on a Saturday night. There's a load of bands playing. We've got Markdown, Raw Nerve, Scumbeat. We got Rust coming over from Australia. X Features are going to do something, and then of course, you know, Bank Robbers will close the night with some you know, annoying covers.
That's a massive lineup.
What's that?
It's a massive lineup. A lot of bands.
Well, yeah. Well, not only that, you know, we've got people like yourself in between the bands DJing.
Indeed.
We've got this time around, we've got the front bar that we're going to have as a kind of like cool. some you know, merchandise stuff, not just from the bands playing, but, you know, other, like, you know, punk stuff and so on that you can buy.
Yeah.
And we're also going to have some information booths from some organizations that you know, I think people should know more about, right?
Cool.
You know,
yep. Yep.
You know, that kind of that are in the punk thing. But yeah, so we haven't finalized that, but there will be some, you know, information booths from organizations that people should know about, or you know, should know more about, even if they know about them.
Yep.
And then after the whole gig finishes, I believe the Dirtbag Radio guys are going to get together with myself and Dom and Elise, I think, is playing as well, and so on,
yeah.
in the front bar, and we're just going to, like, party all night long
cool.
until the King's Arms gets rid of us or gets fed up with us and kicks us out. So it's like, at the moment, doors are planning on being at 8 o'clock, and then I don't expect to be leaving the venue until about 5 in the morning.
Indeed.
So, you know, that's the way I like – that's why it's called Punk It Up. It's a frickin' event. It's not just a whole bunch of bands playing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's something where you get bang for your money. You know what I mean, right?
Indeed.
You know, there's definitely going to be some special guests, but unfortunately, I'm under contractual obligation to not name who they are.
No. I like surprises. It's, you know, all good.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there'll be a couple of pleasant surprises, shall we say?
Yep.
And again, those are still in the formation stage at the moment, but they're looking pretty good.
Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, so it's going to be a good night, Saturday, April the 8th,
yep.
at the King's Arms.
All right, excellent. Again, Andrew, we'll wrap it up. Anything you'd like to add as a closure? Well, I think we've sort of covered everything, or what are your thoughts? All good?
My thoughts are that, like, you know, just keep doing whatever you're doing. Like, you know, if you can get off your ass and help, you know, what you see as the good part of society in any way, and especially, you know, the music scene, right, then do it. You know, you don't have to be a musician to, you know, go out and help out at the door or, you know, be a roadie or do this or do that or whatever, right? You know, and you don't have to make millions of dollars to do it, because, you know, it's something that you should do, you know, from your heart as well as your pay, as well as your wallet, right? You know,
and
I think also that, you know, people learn three chords, go and play in a band, right? It's easy enough to do. It's like, you know, equipment, there's a lot of equipment around. It's not hella cheap, but it's cheap enough to get yourself going. And you know, and if Lars from Rancid can record on a four-track cassette, then so can you, you know, right? It's like all of this stuff is doable. You've just got to reach out and get off your ass and do it, right? And if you sit at home and complain and talk shit about people and talk shit about bands and everything else like that, you're really not doing the world a favor. So, you know, I mean, I think, you know, people and this is my opinion, obviously, but, you know, people should shut up and get off their ass and do stuff, because it's better for the world.
Wise words indeed. Excellent. Okay, thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure. And we'll see you in April. Looking forward to it.
Sounds good, Phil.
Good on you, mate.
Sure, mate.
Okay, ciao. Cheers for that, eh?